Chapter 21. At 2 and 30 years of age, John became King of England. His pretty little nephew Arthur had the best claim to the throne, but John seized the treasure, and made fine promises to the nobility, and got himself crowned at Westminster within a few weeks after his brother Richard's death. I doubt whether the crown could possibly have been put upon the head of a meaner coward, or a more detestable villain, if England had been searched from end to end to find him out. The French king, Philip, refused to acknowledge the right of John to his new dignity, and declared in favor of Arthur. You must not suppose that he had any generosity of feeling for the fatherless boy. It merely suited his ambitious schemes to oppose the King of England. So John and the French king went to war about Arthur. He was a handsome boy, at that time only 12 years old. He was not born when his father, Geoffrey, had his brains trampled out at the tournament, and, besides the misfortune of never having known a father's guidance and protection, he had the additional misfortune to have a foolish mother, Constance by name, lately married to her third husband. She took Arthur, upon John's accession, to the French king, who pretended to be very much his friend, and who made him a knight, and promised him his daughter in marriage, but who cared so little about him in reality, that finding it his interest to make peace with King John for a time, he did so without the least consideration for the poor little prince, and heartlessly sacrificed all his interests. Young Arthur, for 2 years afterwards, lived quietly, and in the course of that time his mother died. But, the French king then finding it his interest to quarrel with King John again made Arthur his pretense, and invited the orphan boy to court. You know your rights, prince, apostrophe said the French king, and you would like to be a king. Is it not so? Apostrophe truly, said Prince Arthur, I should greatly like to be a king. Apostrophe said Philip, you shall have 200 gentlemen who are knights of mine, and with them, you shall go to win back the provinces belonging to you, of which your uncle, the usurping King of England, has taken possession. I myself, meanwhile, will head a force against him in Normandy. Apostrophe poor Arthur was so flattered, and so grateful, that he signed a treaty with the crafty French king, agreeing to consider him his superior lord, and that the French king should keep for himself whatever he could take from King John. Now, King John was so bad in all ways, and King Philip was so perfidious, that Arthur, between the two, might as well have been a lamb between a fox and a wolf. But, being so young, he was ardent, and flushed with hope, and, when the people of Brittany, which was his inheritance, sent him 500 more knights and 5,000 foot soldiers, he believed his fortune was made. The people of Brittany had been fond of him from his birth, and had requested that he might be called Arthur, in remembrance of that dimly famous English Arthur, of whom I told you early in this book, whom they believed to have been the brave friend and companion of an old king of their own. They had tales among them about a prophet called Merlin of the same old time, who had foretold that their own king should be restored to them after hundreds of years, and they believed that the prophecy would be fulfilled in Arthur, that the time would come when he would rule them with a crown of Brittany upon his head, and when neither King of France nor King of England would have any power over them. When Arthur found himself riding in a glittering suit of armor on a richly caparisoned horse, at the head of his train of knights and soldiers, he began to believe this too, and to consider old Merlin a very superior prophet. He did not know how could he, being so innocent and inexperienced, that his little army was a mere nothing against the power of the King of England. The French king knew it, but the poor boy's faith was little to him, so that the King of England was worried and distressed. Therefore, King Philip went his way into Normandy and Prince Arthur went his way towards Mirebeau, a French town near Poictiers, both very well pleased. Prince Arthur went to attack the town of Mirebeau, because his grandmother Eleanor, who has so often made her appearance in this history and who had always been his mother's enemy, was living there, and because his knights said, "Prince, if you can take her prisoner, you will be able to bring the king your uncle to terms." But she was not to be easily taken. She was old enough by this time, 80, but she was as full of stratagem as she was full of years and wickedness. Receiving intelligence of young Arthur's approach, she shut herself up in a high tower, and encouraged her soldiers to defend it like men. Prince Arthur with his little army besieged the high tower. King John, hearing how matters stood, came up to the rescue with his army. So here was a strange family party. The boy prince besieging his grandmother, and his uncle besieging him. This position of affairs did not last long. One summer night King John, by treachery, got his men into the town, surprised Prince Arthur's force, took 200 of his knights, and seized the prince himself in his bed. The knights were put in heavy irons, and driven away in open carts drawn by bullocks, to various dungeons where they were most inhumanly treated, and where some of them were starved to death. Prince Arthur was sent to the castle of Fallas. One day, while he was in prison at that castle, mournfully thinking it strange that one so young should be in so much trouble, and looking out of the small window in the deep dark wall, at the summer sky and the birds, the door was softly opened, and he saw his uncle the king standing in the shadow of the archway, looking very grim. "Arthur," said the king, with his wicked eyes more on the stone floor than on his nephew, "will you not trust to the gentleness, the friendship, and the truthfulness of your loving uncle?" "I will tell my loving uncle that," replied the boy, "when he does me right. Let him restore to me my kingdom of England, and then come to me, and ask the question." The king looked at him and went out. "Keep that boy close prisoner," said he to the warden of the castle. Then, the king took secret counsel with the worst of his nobles, how the prince was to be got rid of. Some said, "Put out his eyes, and keep him in prison, as Robert of Normandy was kept." Others said, "Have him stabbed." Others, "Have him hanged." Others, "Have him poisoned." King John, feeling that in any case, whatever was done afterwards, it would be a satisfaction to his mind, to have those handsome eyes burnt out that had looked at him so proudly, while his own royal eyes were blinking at the stone floor, sent certain ruffians to Fallas, to blind the boy with red-hot irons. But Arthur so pathetically entreated them, and shed such piteous tears, and so appealed to Hubert de Bourg, the warden of the castle, who had a love for him, and was an honorable, tender man, that Hubert could not bear it. To his eternal honor he prevented the torture from being performed, and, at his own risk, sent the savages away. The chafed and disappointed King bethought himself of the stabbing suggestion next, and, with his shuffling manner and his cruel face, proposed it to one William de Bray. "I am a gentleman, and not an executioner," said William de Bray, and left the presence with disdain. But it was not difficult for a king to hire a murderer in those days. King John found one for his money, and sent him down to the castle of Fallas. "On what errand dost thou come?" said Hubert to this fellow. "To dispatch young Arthur," he returned. "Go back to him who sent thee," answered Hubert, "and say that I will do it." King John, very well knowing that Hubert would never do it, but that he courageously sent this reply to save the Prince Argyll time, dispatched messengers to convey the young prisoner to the castle of Rouen. Arthur was soon forced from the good Hubert, of whom he had never stood in greater need than then, carried away by night, and lodged in his new prison, where, through his grated window, he could hear the deep waters of the River Seine, rippling against the stone wall below. One dark night, as he lay sleeping, dreaming perhaps of rescue by those unfortunate gentlemen who were obscurely suffering and dying in his cause, he was roused, and bidden by his jailer, to come down the staircase to the foot of the tower. He hurriedly dressed himself and obeyed. When they came to the bottom of the winding stairs, and the night air from the river blew upon their faces, the jailer trod upon his torch, and put it out. Then, Arthur, in the darkness, was hurriedly drawn into a solitary boat. And in that boat, he found his uncle and one other man. He knelt to them, and prayed them not to murder him. Deaf to his entreaties, they stabbed him, and sunk his body in the river with heavy stones. When the spring morning broke, the tower door was closed, the boat was gone, the river sparkled on its way, and never more was any trace of the poor boy beheld by mortal eyes. The news of this atrocious murder being spread in England, awakened the hatred of the king,
already odious for his many vices, and for his having stolen away, and married a noble lady, while his own wife was living, that never slept again through his whole reign.
In Brittany, the indignation was intense. Arthur's own sister Eleanor was in the power of John, and shut up in a convent at Bristol, but his half-sister Alice was in Brittany. The people chose her, and the murdered prince's father-in-law, the last husband of Constance, to represent them, and carried their fiery complaints to King Philip. King Philip summoned King John,
as the holder of territory in France,
to come before him and defend himself. King John refusing to appear, King Philip declared him false, perjured, and guilty, and again made war. In a little time, by conquering the greater part of his French territory, King Philip deprived him of one-third of his dominions. And, through all the fighting that took place, King John was always found, either to be eating and drinking, like a gluttonous fool, when the danger was at a distance, or to be running away, like a beaten cur, when it was near. You might suppose that, when he was losing his dominions at this rate, and when his own nobles cared so little for him, or his cause, that they plainly refused to follow his banner out of England, he had enemies enough. But he made another enemy of the Pope, which he did in this way. The Archbishop of Canterbury dying, and the junior monks of that place wishing to get the start of the senior monks in the appointment of his successor, met together at midnight, secretly elected a certain Reginald, and sent him off to Rome, to get the Pope's approval. The senior monks and the king soon finding this out, and being very angry about it, the junior monks gave way, and all the monks together elected the Bishop of Norwich, who was the king's favorite. The Pope, hearing the whole story, declared that neither election would do for him, and that he elected Stephen Langton. The monks submitting to the Pope, the king turned them all out bodily, and banished them as traitors. The Pope sent three bishops to the king, to threaten him with an interdict. The king told the bishops that if any interdict were laid upon his kingdom, he would tear out the eyes and cut off the noses of all the monks he could lay hold of, and send them over to Rome in that undecorated state as a present for their master. The bishops, nevertheless, soon published the interdict, and fled. After it had lasted a year, the Pope proceeded to his next step, which was excommunication. King John was declared excommunicated, with all the usual ceremonies. The king was so incensed at this, and was made so desperate by the disaffection of his barons, and the hatred of his people, that it is said he even privately sent ambassadors to the Turks in Spain, offering to renounce his religion and hold his kingdom of them, if they would help him. It is related that the ambassadors were admitted to the presence of the Turkish emir through long lines of Moorish guards, and that they found the emir with his eyes seriously fixed on the pages of a large book, from which he never once looked up. That they gave him a letter from the king containing his proposals, and were gravely dismissed. That presently the emir sent for one of them, and conjured him, by his faith in his religion, to say what kind of man the King of England truly was? that the ambassador, thus pressed, replied that the King of England was a false tyrant, against whom his own subjects would soon rise, and that this was quite enough for the emir. Money being, in his position, the next best thing to men, King John spared no means of getting it. He set on foot another oppressing and torturing of the unhappy Jews, which was quite in his way, and invented a new punishment for one wealthy Jew of Bristol. Until such time as that Jew should produce a certain large sum of money, the king sentenced him to be imprisoned, and, every day, to have one tooth violently wrenched out of his head, beginning with the double teeth. For 7 days, the oppressed man bore the daily pain, and lost the daily tooth. But, on the eighth, he paid the money. With the treasure raised in such ways, the king made an expedition into Ireland, where some English nobles had revolted. It was one of the very few places from which he did not run away, because no resistance was shown. He made another expedition into Wales, whence he did run away in the end. But not before he had got from the Welsh people, as hostages, 27 young men of the best families, every one of whom he caused to be slain in the following year. To interdict and excommunication, the Pope now added his last sentence, deposition. He proclaimed John no longer king, absolved all his subjects from their allegiance, and sent Stephen Langton and others to the King of France to tell him that, if he would invade England, he should be forgiven all his sins at least, should be forgiven them by the Pope, if that would do. As there was nothing that King Philip desired more than to invade England, he collected a great army at Rouen, and a fleet of 1,700 ships to bring them over. But the English people, however bitterly they hated the king, were not a people to suffer invasion quietly. They flocked to Dover, where the English standard was, in such great numbers, to enroll themselves as defenders of their native land, that there were not provisions for them, and the king could only select and retain 60,000. But, at this crisis, the Pope, who had his own reasons for objecting to either King John or King Philip being too powerful, interfered. He entrusted a legate, whose name was Pandulf, with the easy task of frightening King John. He sent him to the English camp, from France, to terrify him with exaggerations of King Philip's power, and his own weakness in the discontent of the English barons and people. Pandulf discharged his commission so well, that King John, in a wretched panic, consented to acknowledge Stephen Langton, to resign his kingdom to God, Saint Peter, and Saint Paul, which meant the Pope, and to hold it, ever afterwards, by the Pope's leave, on payment of an annual sum of money. To this shameful contract he publicly bound himself in the Church of the Knights Templars at Dover, where he laid at the legate's feet a part of the tribute, which the legate haughtily trampled upon. But they do say that this was merely a genteel flourish, and that he was afterwards seen to pick it up and pocket it. There was an unfortunate prophet, the name of Peter, who had greatly increased King John's terrors by predicting that he would be unknighted, which the king supposed to signify that he would die before the feast of the Ascension should be passed. That was the day after this humiliation. When the next morning came, and the king, who had been trembling all night, found himself alive and safe, he ordered the prophet and his son to be dragged through the streets at the tails of horses, and then hanged, for having frightened them. As King John had now submitted, the Pope, to King Philip's great Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.